The following program has been brought to you by Rolling Press, a family-run, eco-friendly printing company. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Episode 92 of The Morning After. I am Jesse Kiefer.
I'm Sari Kamen.
Sari, we took a week off.
I missed you.
I missed you very much. It was obviously Thanksgiving. I was actually a guest on Mike Edison's Holiday Riot talking about Thanksgiving menorahs in the shapes of turkeys and all
so
that
wrong.
which was a lot of fun. what did you do for the holiday?
I went up to the lovely area of Westchester, New York, also known as the suburbs.
Never been.
Oh,
truly. Maybe passed on a train, but never actually there.
It took about an hour on a train and suddenly you're just somewhere like totally different in the woods. And it's really, really pretty. I went to my roommate's parents' house.
Isn't that weird when you live in New York City and you're so close to all these things, like specifically the ocean, and you forget that there's actually an ocean?
I know.
There.
I felt like.
Or woods.
I kind of felt like I was camping, even though I was in a home eating food.
I went up to Cape Cod where my grandparents live, and my grandmother made the most of Thanksgiving. My uncle cooked a turkey, and on the way up to Cape Cod, driving, there are, you know, cranberry bogs, and it's just really picturesque.
Wow.
No cranberry sauce on the table.
Oh, speaking of cranberries.
Really?
I just did a piece about cranberries on Heritage Radio Network.
Look at you.
It's all about cranberries. Check it out.
Is it? Is it all about cranberries for Thanksgiving or just throughout the winter
season? It's actually the surprisingly interesting history of cranberries.
Really?
There's some really fun facts.
Do you talk about ocean spray?
I do not.
Do you talk about canned cranberry sauce?
Yes.
Okay, good. I'll read it.
Okay, good.
We also have been noticing, and actually I feel very proud, that we've been seemingly, you know, scooped by several publications.
It's because I told you we have 1 million listeners.
1 million and one,
including,
I think.
Leonard Lopate and The New Yorker.
Someone at New York Mag.
And New York Mag.
We
all of New York Mag.
All of every single one of
as
them.
As a collective.
We I guess we did like a show on food theft. Mm-hmm. And like lo and behold, in New York Magazine
Two weeks later. Yeah. Or maybe a week later.
Was an article about food thefts.
Yes, they had an entire page devoted to all the different food thefts that have been in the news lately. Just 1 week after we spoke about it on air.
Totally fishy. And
we
then
we are watching you, New York Mag.
The same, I think it was the same exact week that we decided to talk to our butcher friend Brian
Mayer.
About you know, how we were interested in our paleo diets and we wanted to butcher a woolly mammoth, and we actually just didn't really want to know how we could physically and actually do that, and we're still working on that.
Work in progress.
There's a lot of fur.
Gosh.
Or hair, is that what you call it?
Both.
We've got several rugs in my new apartment. It's we're working on it. But
I've made 16 coats.
But after we talked to Brian, then lo and behold, there's I think his name is John Durant. I believe that's his name, who is the creator of the paleo diet on Leonard Lopate. Like we're
no
so in sync. We are on the pulse of the food.
I think I would the say
food
the term
world.
Is influencers.
And speaking of on the pulse of the food world, in studio today, we're both very excited about this. Betsy Andrews, executive editor of Sevur. I was telling Betsy earlier that I am absolutely notorious for saying things horribly wrong. How did I do?
You did very well.
Can you just say it?
Sevur.
Your profession. Sounds good. Well, we're going to talk to her. We're actually going to kind of deconstruct how you put together a food magazine such as this and talk about how you got into it and all of those good things.
And we're also going to talk about how she's an award-winning poet as well in her free time when she's not the executive editor or editing. First of all,
how do you become a poet in
we'll
your free time?
That.
I know,
yeah.
I know. We will. I'm already just like racking my
Simmer
brain
down,
with
Jesse.
This. So it's been quite a few episodes since we have visited one of my favorite segments. Part of it is because our famous narrator, the Dame Joan Plowright, the Baroness Olivier, narratoress. I think she's genderless, really, but. the Dame Joan Plowright, the Baroness Olivier, has been on an extended gambling cruise in Morocco, and we've missed her very much. But I think it's time to fill her very tall orthotic shoes and bring back front of house.
It's your favorite story. It's front of house. It's a front of house.
Now, this story is, I actually had kind of like a little stomach bug over the week, and I kind of stopped drinking, and somehow that brought back all of these, like, you know, memories, and it's super weird how that happens. This is from the annals of long, long ago, about coffee. In everyone's life, at some point or another, they have dealt with an overachiever. The kid at the head of the class, the star athlete, the brown noser at the office. Maybe it's you. Maybe it's someone you love, or maybe it's someone you hate. But either way, they will be brought down to size one day, because life is hard and perfect does not exist. This is the story of when I had to remind someone that they were not God, just a lunch server. My former coworker was the stuff of legend. Handsome, athletic, always got the best tips, never seemed to have a bad day. Named after one of the popes, he could lift two bar stools at once, flip them in the air, and place them without a clang on top of the bar. Magical to watch. When we would get a delivery of wine to take downstairs, he would grab not one or two, but three cases to carry. He could play every role in the restaurant without breaking a sweat, kissing babies and shit, until this fateful lunch. It was his first shift of its kind. Different menu, different cocktails, different clientele, but this didn't faze his holiness. As a table of two women finished up their chicken salad sandwiches, he asked if there was anything else he could bring for them. One of the ladies said, "Why, yes, a decaf coffee." With the utmost confidence, he said, "Of course." As he floated back to the server station, he asked me with a glowing smile, "Where do we keep the decaf coffee?" "Well, we don't have decaf," I said. And for the first time, I saw him struggling, searching for the answer, because he was always the one with the answers, and because telling his guests he was wrong was not an option. After a few minutes of blank staring at the espresso machine, he victoriously declared, "I will decaffeinate the coffee." And just like Jesus turning water into wine, he attempted to decaffeinate the coffee himself. He grabbed the grounds, cradled it into a filter, turned on the cold water faucet, and let the water run over the coffee in his hands. I know little about coffee and how it's decaffeinated, but what I do know is that the beans must soak in water to remove the caffeine for what I imagine is hours, maybe days. After about 5 minutes, with his table searching the room for their decaf, he was still staunchly bending at the sink, sleeves rolled up, letting the water pour, and convinced he could make this happen. This is the moment I had to break it to him, that in fact his section was going under and I was too busy to let him waste our tips over a goddamned cup of Joe Light. "Just tell them we ran out of decaf," I snapped. "Really, just tell them no. They've heard it before." He hung his head, mourning his failed attempt. Maybe it would have worked had he stuck to it, but that's not the point. The point is that sometimes we all need to learn our own worldly limitations. Thank you. Thank you very much. A shout out to that former server. He's an incredible human. But you cannot decaffeinate coffee in 5 minutes.
That was a really nice dramatic reading.
Well, thank you so much. Let's take a break here. And let's
recover.
Let's recover. Let's think about how we all would have decaffeinated that coffee. And we're going to come back with Betsy Andrews of Sabre magazine.
That's hilarious.
Well, I'm tired of laying around this town. Tired of laying.
This one's called "Bye Bye Baby, I'm Gone" by the California Honey Drops on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Circling around the sun.
Today's program was brought to you by Rolling Press. Rolling Press is a family-run digital and offset print house that brings together eco-friendly methods, ethical practices, and personalized service. Using environmentally responsible papers, non-toxic inks, and wind power, Rolling Press represents the harmony of traditional craftsmanship and mindful sustainability. Rolling Press offers advice on reducing paper waste and energy consumption, helping you save money and minimize your carbon footprint. For more information, visit rollingpress.com.
Hi, we are back at The Morning After. I'm your co-host, Sari Kamen, here with Jesse Kiefer.
Hello.
And our guest today, we are so excited to have her, is Betsy Andrews. She's the executive editor of Saveur Magazine. In my humble opinion, the best food magazine.
Whoa.
Yes, you heard it here first. So, hi, Betsy.
Hi.
Yeah, welcome to The Morning After.
Thanks.
Yeah, I'm a student at NYU in addition to being a professional co-host. And a couple weeks ago in my food media class, Betsy came in and spoke about her position at Saveur. And it was just so interesting to listen to that I just had to just snatch her up and get her to come on the show and reiterate all the really interesting things she talked to us about. She also mentioned to us that she was a poet, which just kind of blows my mind because she's an award-winning, she's not just like one of those, like, oh, I'm a poet. Like, she's a poet.
Like, I write in my journal.
Yeah, no, she's actually a poet, and she's won awards. So, she's won the Brittingham Award for her poem and book, New Jersey. And word on the street is she just won another award. Betsy, yes. Tell us. Yes. Break the news.
I did. It's for my second book, which comes out next September 2014. It won the 42 Miles Press Poetry Prize, and it will be coming out on 42 Miles Press. It's called The Bottom.
Wow. Well, congratulations. Thank you. That's just so exciting. And I guess before we kind of like start at the beginning, I really want to hear, and I think Jesse does too, how do you manage your time and how do you split they're two different careers, really.
Yep.
So, I mean, is there a way where they intersect, or are they just like two opposing, you know, lives that you lead?
Yeah. You know, it can be tough. But so I was a poet before I was a food writer. I was an eater before I was a poet and a cook. But when I did an MFA, I was in a PhD program in anthropology, had an epistemological crisis, laughed. Became a poet, went and did an MFA. When I was leaving the MFA, I thought to myself, okay, well, I got to get a gig in New York. I want to write. I had a job at an ill-fated website, and then I was looking for work. And the only place out of the zillions of applications I sent out that I got an interview was at Zagat. And that had to do with friends that I had who, you know, sort of said, please give her an interview. You know, I mean, I was, Pete Wells is my college roommate.
That doesn't hurt.
Little known secret. Also, I had waited a lot of I did a lot of front of house myself in New York. So I had that sort of experience. And putting together those little Zagat, you know, reviews with little quotes from people, it's like a found poem. Mm-hmm. So for me, that was very easy, you know. And then after that, I just sort of went on to job after job. The New Jersey, this book of poetry, actually prompted my first New York Times story because it's an anti-war meditation on the New Jersey Turnpike. And in it, there's this refrain about the fast food places at the rest stops. And I thought to myself one day, well, you know, if you actually want to really eat and you're stuck on the New Jersey Turnpike, like, what do? You didn't bring a sandwich with you. What do? So I pitched this piece to the Times, and I spent like 6 months getting off at every single exit and finding what food there was to find, you know, what deliciousness there was to eat at every single exit of the New Jersey Turnpike. I wrote this big piece for the Escape section, which no longer exists. It was called United Plates of New Jersey. It was a huge piece, giant above the fold, beautiful online gallery. I was so excited. I've got this piece. I'm on the train at like 2 o'clock in the morning, going home, looking at the galley. It's going to come out the next day. And a woman came up to me and she said, hey, do you write for the New York Times? I used to write for the New York Times. I'm Dana Bowen, the executive editor of Saveur Magazine.
Shut up.
And today, I have her job.
It's a little too perfect. I mean, that was the thing that really struck me about when you spoke in my class, is like how many just unbelievable serendipitous things had happened to you that, you know, accumulated in a way that now you're here. And you spoke to us about how Sever had always been your favorite magazine.
That's right.
And you, you know, like lusted waiting for the new issue to come out and had always collected all of them. And there was something that felt a little bit like, like meant to be.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, yes. I don't, if you felt that.
Yeah. You know, I absolutely do feel that. So, you know, I was at work one day. I was the online editor at this old house, actually. And which I don't really know anything about. I live in an old house, but I, you know, I can't so even
this
use a
Bob
hammer.
Vila, right? Oh yeah, man, I hate yeah. when that would come.
But
up.
I need a Bob Vila in my life. You know, I need. I actually can't do this work myself, although I can cook and I can eat. So I one day was just a little bit like, you know, over things. I looked on Media Bistro, the clearinghouse for, you know, media jobs, and I saw this. This posting for a senior editor job at Sever. So I immediately contacted Dana Bowen because, yeah, things are serendipitous, but I also just knew when the opportunities were there. So I kept people's contacts. I kept friends with people. And she was like, I've been thinking about you. Come on in. And so that's how I ended up at Sever. As an anthropologist and as a poet, this is, and as a food lover, this is the perfect magazine for me. There's culture, there's incredible writing, and there's food. I mean, it is, you know, I'm sort of the perfect audience for this magazine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jesse and I were talking about that before the show, is that Sever, for me, really stands out and why I like it more than other food magazines, is that there is a narrative behind every single recipe. Yeah. There's never just recipes for the sake of, you know, supplying recipes for people who are interested in food. It's for people who love food and are nostalgic about food and are interested in history and culture and the trajectory of food stories. And it's just amazing. It just makes the recipes that much more meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
So do you want to talk a little bit about how these narratives come to be, or
sure.
how you think about them, or, you know, what makes a great narrative, or what really
sure.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've taught a lot of food writing, and I always have my students start with a personal essay. You know, their sort of relationship to food, similar to the story that you, you know, gave us today. And that's because, you know, first of all, people who want to be food writers, you know, it's a kind of crowded field. It's a small and crowded field. So you need to figure out what you particularly bring. What is your special gift that you're bringing into this world? And usually, you know, people come from, they have different cultural backgrounds. They have different experiences. And those experiences really inform their relationship to food. And all of those experiences are unique. You know, you can pitch the same story that everybody else out there is pitching. And, you know, somebody else has told it already. One thing that Pete Wells actually did say when he came to my class is, you know, somebody said, what are you looking for in a pitch? And he said, you know, everybody's looking this way. I'm turning right. And he said, I'm looking for the person who's looking that way. I'm turning left. All right. So uniqueness really helps with, you know, personal narrative really helps with uniqueness. Also, food is not just food, right? Food is a metaphor for everything about us. So the stories in Sever resonate more deeply than just a recipe. They are about history, culture, you know, human relationships. And that really, we are a magazine about culture through the lens of food.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, I think that's also a perfect metaphor that you said about, you know, looking one way while everyone else is looking the other way in terms of Sever and the way you approach food. Like, for example, the cover of Sever, this current issue, is duck.
Yes.
And the last issue for Thanksgiving, it was not turkey.
It was chicken.
Right.
Really good chicken, by the way.
Yeah, and why don't you tell the story of, you know, what you told my class, why you chose not to do turkey?
Okay. Well, you know, turkey is almost obligatory for a cover for Thanksgiving. And, you know, on the newsstand, I mean, it plays well, you know. However, there's a zillion turkeys on the newsstand. And, you know, you can also get a little tired of it, even though it is the icon of Thanksgiving. A few years ago, we put green beans on the cover. didn't sell it well. Subscribers loved it, and also the media loved it because it was a sort of maverick thing to do. So this year, when we were putting together the cover, we looked at the turkey shot that we had inside. Now, this is a beautiful turkey. It's a piece by Mary Sue Milliken, the chef, California. And about going home to Kansas and making Thanksgiving, great looking turkey. But when we looked at this up next to the piece that we had for the source column, which is our sort of mail order column, the chicken looked that much more delicious. And so we just made a aesthetic choice and decided on the chicken, and I think it's kind of hilarious. And I will also say that this chicken from Joyce Farms in North Carolina, which is made by through genes that come from French farmhouse chickens, and just they're happy and utterly delicious chicken, is really the best chicken you're ever going to have in your life.
That's the chicken you found at the fancy food in
Wyoming. I found this at the fancy food show. Now there are tens of thousands of products at the Fancy Food Show. And amongst those tens of thousands of products, there are going to be a handful that have a great story and are really delicious and are really real. And this was the winner this year. This was the thing that I found, this Joyce Farm chicken.
When you wrote an online post about how you weren't so into chicken, right? I feel like I
maybe
read something that way.
I did. Yes.
You're like, I'm not so into chicken. It's like, this freaking chicken.
That's right. Also, I will say one more tip for you food lovers out there. This chicken was cooked with Christian Deluvier's recipe. Now, Christian Deluvier, we know, 3-star Michelin chef, 4-star New York Times chef, the famous chef from Lutèce, decides to retire. And what does he do? He goes to eat one day at a little bistro called La Maggiore on the Upper East Side. And I'm probably pronouncing that wrong.
It's okay. I do it all the time.
Right. It's like pronouncing the name of the magazine wrong. And he was so charmed by this place and the host owner there that he ended up like working there. And now these two old French gentlemen with this incredible restaurant, and this is sort of his retirement, is just, this leisurely, it's so French, bistro. It's like their stucco walls are so intense. They could, they're sort of sharp, but the food is amazing. And what he does with his chicken is he rubs it with soy sauce and butter. Mm. He, fills the cavity with a little bit of garlic and a lot of thyme. He ties the legs up over the breast to keep the breast moist. And then he roasts that at like 450 or something, 475. And it's phenomenal. It's the easiest chicken recipe and the best that you will ever find.
That sounds amazing.
You can get it on Savoir.com.
Let's grab a break here. Let's salivate over the chicken. We're going to come back and we're going to talk more about Savoir with Betsy.
Yay.
This Morning After on Heritage Radio Network.
You are listening to the Honey Drops theme by the California Honey Drops on the Heritage Radio Network.org.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
We made a little coin, built a time machine, and picked up Mr. Boynes. Everybody's having fun, and we only just begun. We gonna party till the morning come. We gonna party till the morning come.
We're back here on The Morning After. Our guest today is Betsy Andrews, executive editor of Savoir magazine. I'm still not pronouncing that right, I'm sure. The glossy pages of this magazine are freaking gorgeous. And I am a completely amateur chef. I really like chopping things. I'm really good at creating the mise en place. But what is the kind of accessibility to everyone as far as a kind of amateur cook? Can I approach this magazine and cook everything on these pages?
You absolutely can. And hopefully if we've done our jobs, then we've given you the tools to do that. So, you know, first there are these inspirational stories in Savera. There's also unbelievable photography. It is a very visual magazine that's extremely important to us. So you look at it and you're excited. And that's the first step, right, to good cooking. Then after that, there are the recipes. And not only are there recipes, but there are also in the kitchen section of the magazine in the back of the book, which is a sort of a how-to section, and throughout the pieces, sidebars and that are technique pieces, tips pieces that help you to cook what's in the magazine. We don't want people to, we don't want to shy away from the whole range of the world of food, and we want people to be able to try new things. So, you know, and particularly around the holidays, people are going to spend a little more money. They're going to be willing to sort of, showcase something kind of, try something sort of exciting and elegant and new. So in this issue, we have a piece on, king crab and snow crab. We have a piece on duck. Those are fairly luxury, ingredients, but, the way that we break it down for you, you should be able to cook these things, and you'll spend a little money on that around the holidays and treat yourself and your loved ones to something delicious.
I mean, I think already just showcasing snow crab next to king crab, you're already creating a more affordable option by putting the snow crab in.
Sure.
Which is certainly the way I will approach some of these recipes.
Right on.
And as we were talking about earlier, the narratives in here are truly at least for me, what gets me excited about cooking. It's I work in the wine business, so the story of how that wine was made is what gets me excited, and what I can throw that to my guests. I feel so often that food magazines, and I mean just magazines in general, aren't doing great. Things are hard. Online is taking over, and do you feel like these narratives are kind of the future of food magazine journalism or recipes?
Well, no, I would say that that there's a lot of approaches in the food magazine world, and two sort of basic ones. And one is very recipe driven with very, very little text, very few narratives. And some of, our major competitors do that, and they do that well. But Savers, for now we're going to be 20 years old in 2014, actually. And that's starting to have some longevity. That's some legs. And our success depends on sticking to our brand mission, and that is storytelling. And because of that, that's the thing that Savers started a long time ago. There are a lot of new publications out there that do that. So there's an explosion of food zines and new food magazines and blogs, and everybody's telling stories. So I feel like there's something that has really like touched a nerve in that approach to food writing. And so it's pretty interesting and exciting. There's a ton of stories out there. I would like to say something about the recipes in the magazine, however.
Please do.
As you were asking about the cooking. So when you're developing recipes, and we work in a big loft space in Koreatown, and there's a big open kitchen there. The place is filled with delicious smells and delicious flavors, we're sort of, tasting all day long and cooking all day. We get recipes and we test and test and test them. And when we're testing them, we're thinking about a few things. One is the photograph, right? So we're actually even even shopping, for how is this photograph going to look? Because we shoot with natural light. We shoot with no tricks. We shoot right there on the conference room table at Savera. The studio shots are done right there, totally bare bones. So we want things to look really great. The second thing is that when we're developing recipes, we are thinking about accessibility. We get recipes from chefs, and they can be very difficult. So our kitchen staff is sort of expert at breaking that down and changing it into something that home cooks can cook. And like a good example is I was doing this piece about cooking with beer. And I asked Cosmo Goss, who is the chef at Publican Restaurant in Chicago, fantastic restaurant, amazing young chef, who had won this contest up at Oma Gang, this Hop Chef beer cooking contest, to please give me a recipe. The recipe he gave me was one that he can easily execute, but it was very, very long and very complicated. And, you know, we took that recipe and we sort of squeezed it and boiled it down into something that is still delicious, but is a home cook's version, you know, of what that recipe is. It went from, you know, 2,000 words to a couple hundred words. And hopefully we kept some integrity of the original dish, some of the flavor, kept the flavors of the original dish, but made it something that you yourself can cook at home.
You said two things that reminded me of things that you had said before when you spoke in my class. And the first is, you were one of kind of the pioneers of food blog writing, and it would be great if you could talk about that, because you were one of the first people to bring that to the forefront. And then second, in terms of the aesthetic and the photography that you do at Sever, there's a very naturalistic approach. And, you know, we talked about this because I said something to you about, you know, like, why wasn't the plate wiped?
Right.
And you said, well, that's on purpose. And I love that. I mean, I love how Sever is a little bit edgier in that way. But it makes it more accessible that, you know, it doesn't, it's not realistic to have a plate full of this, like, juicy, just saucy duck. And, you know, there's no little stuff on the side of the plate, and that was very much intentional, and I love that about, you know, the fact that there's no ingredients that go into your photos that aren't edible whatsoever. So that I thought was really great, but I'd love if you would retell your story about your blog for Food and Wine.
All right. And then maybe I can mention something about those photos.
Okay.
So,
I didn't mean to not give you the opportunity.
That's cool. It's all right. You said it really well.
You can say whatever you want.
So when I had been at Sagat for like 5 years, and I wanted to move my career along, although, you know, it was fun while it lasted there. And I was looking for jobs. I had never worked at a magazine, so I could get in the door because I knew people, but I couldn't get hired. So I thought, oh, I'm going to have to make up my own project. What am I going to do? Then Katrina happened in New Orleans. Now, New Orleans is one of my favorite places in the world. I mean, if you're an eater and a drinker and you like music, like, you got to love that town.
I hate all those things.
So I came up with an idea. I pitched Food and Wine, and I knew Dana Cowan, the editor-in-chief of Food and Wine, because I had actually I had interviewed for a job there, which I didn't get, but I kept friendly with her because I this is a good thing to know her. And I pitched her this idea that I would go down to New Orleans, work in restaurant kitchens, and write about the rebuilding of the restaurant industry after Katrina. She said, that sounds like a great idea. We're not interested in it for the magazine. So I said to her, well, how about a blog? And Food and Wine did not have at that time a blog. They had never done a blog, and they were interested in it. And so they said, yeah, let's do this. It was 2005. You can tell it's called On the Line in New Orleans. You can still find it online. You can tell that it's 2005 because the photographs were teeny tiny. I took them all myself. They blow up a little bit bigger if you click on them, but teeny tiny. I took them all myself. I wrote these blog posts. They were fairly long blog posts, you know, which was also shows sort of that it was around 2005 because people kind of didn't know about blog length. People got much shorter in blog length. Now they're going back to longer, right? So we're sort of retro now. People are going back to these longer blog posts, and that's what I was writing. And I worked in a number of restaurant kitchens and wrote about the rebuilding of the restaurant industry. It was an unbelievable experience. And the reason I ended up doing it is that I had actually started talking to PR people about this idea. And once you talk to PR people about things, like, the ball gets rolling. They're like, we have a place for you to stay. We have chefs for you to meet. We can get you down there. You know, yeah, okay, right? And I was like, oh, God, I've told too many people about it. I'm going to embarrass myself if I don't do this. So I did it. So I leapt. So one piece of advice I always give people is that if you can't get somebody to just hire you, come up with your own project. Man, you know, do a radio show. Start a blog. You know, make your name yourself.
No, yeah. I totally agree with that. And I think that, yeah, just jumping in there. You had so many life experiences that weren't just career related because of what you chose yes. to do, which I think is great. So I guess let's go back to the photos
yeah, mm-hmm. sure.
that are not small, tiny photos. Mm-hmm. These are big, fancy right. photos.
So I think, you know, this very naturalistic approach of Severs comes out of the fact that we do tons of on-the-ground reporting, right? We travel all over the world. The editors travel all over the world. I mean, I'm in between trips right now. I was in Napa and Sonoma last week. I'm going to Miami and Vero Beach next week. You know, this coming year, I have some major trips planned. We all do. We travel a ton, and our writers travel a ton, and our writers live all over the world, and our photographers meet them and photograph out there. So it's a very documentary approach to, and a very, you know, a very, documentary approach to food journalism. And because of that, you know, we get into home cooks' kitchens all the time, and that's real. And, you know, people've got, like, their you know, stuff, their tchotchkes all over the place. Their cabinets are open, whatever. They've got chip plates and stuff. That's what you see in the magazine. So then when we do studio shoots, we want that to really look as real and as authentic. And we want the food to look like, you know what, this is really food that people really eat. People really eat this food. And we do eat it, too. We photograph it, and we eat it. So that's I think, like, the number one hallmark of Severs, actually, is the way it looks visually and the fact that it looks real because the stories and the food are real.
Yeah. I mean, one of the most compelling things about visually what happens with the recipes and the stories behind it is not just the pictures of the food, but the pictures of the faces
right.
of the people who are involved with the
That's
food.
Right.
I mean, those are really striking.
And yeah. And that. Not every photograph has food in it.
Right.
You know, sometimes it's just a portrait.
Yeah. I mean, to really connect, you know, that's the woman that was, you know, stirring that pot in, you know, whatever country. And the Palestinian
yes.
Food that's in Severs this issue. You spoke about that a little bit. It's a bit controversial. I mean, there was, you know, maybe a reason it didn't go on the cover.
Well, it's controversial in as much as anything about Palestine is you know, raises controversy. So it's not, it's food, it's community, it's family. It's that in itself is not controversial. It's just that, you know, you report in certain places in the world
sure.
and people have feelings about it, which we were very sensitive to.
It's not political, but, you know, the context is.
Right. And you know, I think for us, you know, if we can show, you know, if we are doing our jobs, we are showing the human element of food. We're showing, like, the humanity and the community and the love and, you know, behind that food. And ultimately that food's, you know, ability to help people sort of transcend, you know, conflict
mm-hmm.
And deal with conflict. You know, then we've told a really important story, I think.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead, Jenna.
No, I was going to say, I mean, it really is a story about food, is a story about people, is a story
That's right.
about someone's life. And, you know, in checking out your work, I came across the article that you did in 2010 about your grandmother
mm-hmm.
in Diners. And
yeah.
that really touched me because I think that all of my favorite moments with my grandmothers, with my family, are about food.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really great that a magazine is kind of reiterating that and recreating that. And that shows to me how this touches other people and not just myself.
Yeah.
So. Thank you.
Yeah, actually, that's a little bit what I was going to say. I just wanted to hear before we wrap up about your own personal food story or, you know, what was your childhood like and how did food play a part of it and how has that mm-hmm. affected, you know, your trajectory and your position now at
sure.
Severs.
So I've written about this, and I still have many more stories to tell, actually. But, I've written about this in Severs, both this piece that you're referring to, which is about my mother's mother, my Jewish grandma, who was an incredible cook and an incredible eater. On her deathbed, my mother brought her a corned beef sandwich, and she said, next time, a little more fat. You know, it's just the most hopeful, incredibly optimistic, so beautiful thing to say. So I spent a lot of time with her, and her kitchen was always filled with incredible smells. She cooked a chicken in a pot, you know, with caramelized onions and its own, you know, fat on the stove. She made incredible, you know, cookies and fudge. I spent a lot of time with her. I also, spent some concentrated time whenever she was around or whenever we were up where she was with my father's mother, who was an even more incredible cook. She lived in the mountains of the Poconos, and she really kind of fed everybody around her. She was a big, hearty mountain woman. She would go ice fishing in the middle of the winter. You know, she would, you know, pick blueberries. Her sons would shoot a deer, and she'd make venison kielbasa. She made the incredible pierogies. That's like my soul food. So I had these two great, fantastic grandmother cooks, and my father also cooked. My mother really didn't cook, so dinner in my house was Szechuan Royale or Boston-style pizza, you know? Lots and lots of takeout. And I think that, you know, I adore my mother, but I think actually the fact that she didn't cook meant that all me and my brother and my sisters, we all cook, you know. I always say it skips a generation in Jewish families, you know.
I'd agree with that. Yeah. No offense, Mom.
Yeah. So, and in fact, my very first job was at Boston Style Pizza.
I have no idea what Boston Style Pizza means.
Yeah, isn't that funny? It's hilarious because it was in the Philadelphia suburbs. It was called Boston Style Pizza, and it was owned by Greeks.
I'm assuming it was deep dish. No, that's it was Chicago.
It wasn't deep dish, yeah. But it was a sort of a puffy kind of a crust, a very yeasty, puffy crust. Very cheesy, and all the pizza places in the area were owned by Greek guys, and they all made the same kind of pizza.
The Greeks run the world; they really do. Betsy, one more guy.
Tell us where we can get your books, and if you have a website, and where we can read your poems. And
sure. So I don't know. I have to get on that, but anyway, New Jersey. You can get it from Amazon. You can also get it from University of Wisconsin Press. The Bottom will be out next September, 42 Miles Press. You'll be able to get it there, also on Amazon and through Small Press Traffic in San Francisco. And Sever, you can find on your newsstands. You can go to sever.com. You can find it, Whole Foods has it and Barnes & Noble has it. And you can also, please, subscribe.
Great. Betsy, it's been really great to have you here, learn more about the magazine, and I can't wait to see next month's issue.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure. I can't wait to read your poems, too. Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sari.
Thank you, Jesse.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website, or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.